I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact.
Gentlemen,
hi, how are y'all doing?
Hey, ma'am, what do we know?
My wife reported he had that.
Still fresh?
The sheriff of Brooks County, Texas, has a serious problem. Almost every week, his office gets a call about another dead body in the remote ranch lands that make up much of the county. Most of the victims are found just with the clothes they were wearing, and no identification.
I pronounced one up at the Cage Ranch, where the brothers stayed, the 19 died, the 20-year-old stayed with him, and he stayed with him. You know, and then the coyote took, you know, everything away from all kinds of identifications, and he wouldn't be able to find him, and left him there with his brother. But he stayed with his brother, you know, just to know that you're going to get arrested.
And Brooks County isn't unique. Bodies are found in other Texas counties along the Mexican border all the time.
Over 6,000 migrant deaths were recorded on the U.S. side of the border with Mexico between 1998 and 2013. That's an average of more than one a day, every day for 15 years. The true number of deaths is probably much higher. Many people who try to make the crossing go missing and are never heard from again.
That's Making Contact producer Jasmine Lopez. She says to understand why so many people are dying trying to reach the United States, we have to go back to the 1990s.
That's why our administration has moved aggressively to secure our borders more by hiring a record number of new border guards.
Bill Clinton's presidency marked a major shift along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. In 1994 and 1995, more than 1,000 extra agents were sent to the border to deter would-be migrants from crossing. Places along the border which had once been easier for people to cross suddenly became impassable.
This approach was known as prevention through deterrence. Those who developed this new policy were well aware that the effect would be to force immigrants to cross in more remote parts of the border, in places like Brooks County. To find out what the human cost of prevention through deterrence has been, Jasmine traveled to the border to bring us this special documentary, Deadly Divide.
Una ofrenda de amor para los caminantes, para los más valientes, para los desplazados, los sobrevivientes. Una vela encendida por el corazón de los migrantes, de todos los penitentes, los que como moscas van sobre los techos de los trenes, como carga, como mercancía, como algo disponible, desechable, vulnerable, la brasa inagotable, el torrente.
So we're currently walking through the desert trying to find the body of a man whose wife called him in. And it's really hot out here in the sand. I didn't think the sand was so soft. It's pretty difficult to walk through. A lot of brush around us. A lot of branches with thorns. I'm good, thank you. If the body is found, Judge Raul Ramirez will pronounce the person dead. He's walking with a group of men. Deputy Elias Pompa, the Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue Team, and Funeral Director Alonzo Rangel, in the desert of Brooks County, Texas, a place where searches like this are all too common.
We just came across the body that they've been looking for, and it took us quite a while to get out here. It's pretty hot. I can't imagine even preparing for this. And having to sit through this for days while hiding.
The body is face down in high grass beneath a group of oak trees. He's shirtless and wears modern jeans with a purple canvas belt. His tennis shoes and socks are beside him.
They're going to be taking some photos, and after that, we're probably going to look at the clothing, and then they're going to try to get an ID. So he'll be carrying an ID with him.
We know very little about him. We only know that he was with a group of 20 migrants that walked through Brooks County. He, along with his wife and another man, were separated from the group. When he died, she kept walking and was eventually detained by Border Patrol. She told them where to find his body. Rangel puts on his blue gloves and inspects the body before Ramirez pronounces him dead. The ID he was found with led us to believe he was 19. But we later found out it wasn't his. He wasn't 19. He was 20.
and his name was Joel Mejia Santizo from Guatemala.
We ready, Mr. Alonso?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Joel was pronounced dead at 1:41 p.m., 2 days after his death. He is the 48th body found and picked up by Brooks County Sheriffs in 2014.
David?
Gomez. Gomez. Santis Diobi, November 13th, 1983.
I began to wonder about his life back home, where he had purchased those jeans, if he was proud to wear them. Perhaps he changed into them for what may have been the last leg of his journey. I wondered what conversations he and his wife may have had as they prepared to leave their home in Guatemala.
Hi guys, don't be shy.
It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of migrants attempt to cross the U.S. border each year.
I'm quite a few feet behind Border Patrol that's carrying the body. Seven guys carrying the body, and I think it's pretty heavy and it's a really bad smell. So they have to keep switching positions.
After what seems like half an hour, we make it back to the truck. The Border Patrol search trauma and rescue team discuss how they will transport the body out of the desert, on the hood or inside the truck. After some struggle, he's finally placed inside the truck that Rangel and I ride back to the meeting point, then the town of Falfurrias. As we begin the drive out, we are still overwhelmed by the heat, and now that the body is in the truck with us, the smell. I ask Rangel about the difficulty of finding bodies in this desert.
Start to think about it, how did the person even get out here in the first place? You know, it's real easy to get turned around. You notice how we kind of walked in this direction, and I thought we were going that direction, and it just seemed like to me it would have been shorter just to walk out straight. That's just not the case.
Migrants are often dropped off by smugglers 13 miles south of Falfurrias to avoid a Border Patrol checkpoint. Sometimes without warning, they're told to walk around the checkpoint for several days until they pass it and reach a pickup point.
People have no idea what these poor, you know, souls are doing out here, what they're actually encountering. Look at all the land around you, and there's no landmarks. You can't see anything except more trees, you know. So there's no way you can direct yourself towards something. That's the reason they wind up getting lost. The people are starting to move further and further away from your regular roads. And that's where they wind up out here. And we've had cases where we found, you know, women, you know, that had children's clothing with them, and you wonder if they even had a child with them. Yeah. And that's difficult. I've been out there when there's a father and his son passed away, trying to find a better life, and did not find it. So yeah, there's a lot of sadness out here.
I'm Elias. I'm 21 years old and come from Honduras.
For reasons that will become obvious later, we will only use Elias's first name.
Life in Honduras was a hustle on the street, ruined by drugs.
Like many who choose to make the dangerous crossing to the United States, Elias says he left Honduras because of the violence there. Honduras has the world's highest murder rate. Last year, 7,000 people were murdered. That's 19 per day. Gangs are a part of life. You either join or you die. He tells me his grandmother could no longer cope with him, and his life was at risk.
Me sentí triste, llorando. Le dije a mi abuela de Corinto, mamá.
I felt sad. I went to my grandmother in tears. Mama, you know what? I'm not going to Belize. Where are you going? She asked. I'm going to the United States. You're crazy. Go to Belize with your uncle. Nope, I'm not going to Belize. I'm going to the United States. She told me, I hope it goes well, son. I forgive you for everything you've done to me. Above all, I love you. Be careful on that road and call us.
Brooks County can't afford its own medical examiner. So when bodies like Joel's are found, they're sent 90 miles away to Webb County for an autopsy. This is where Joel was found to have died of hyperthermia, from exposure to heat. Next, they're brought here to Texas State University in San Marcos to be processed.
You guys got a lot done today.
We did?
We did.
Yeah. This is almost a full skeleton. As you can see under here, these are some of the border crossers that are waiting to be processed. So we have somewhere around 40, maybe 45, out at the facility waiting to be finished decomposing. And then in this room, there's about 6 of them waiting to be processed.
That's Haley Decker, the laboratory manager. She tells me that processing entails cleaning and boiling the bones until the tissue is completely removed.
So we're just working to help and give that biological profile to help identify them. So we don't know too much about this individual in terms of a backstory or where they were found. We're just working on our end to give a full profile, biological profile of what we have.
This team is piecing together scraps of information that these bodies carry with them. Hair, clothing, jewelry, anything that they could match to missing persons reports. There's also another team that works to process and identify the found bodies that have already decomposed or that have been exhumed.
When I look at this individual, I believe we have a female, and I'd spend quite a bit of time making a good determination of the age and giving a good age range, but I would say that she was somewhere in her 20s and at the very latest, very early 30s.
Dr. Lori Baker is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Baylor University. She examines the remains of a woman found in Brooks County. She says bones can tell you a lot about an individual's life and death.
And she did a lot of heavy work. We can see that by looking at the development of her muscle attachments and the changes we see to the bone because of that type of work. We can also see it when we look at the clavicle.
Baker and her students began exhuming the remains of unidentified individuals buried in unmarked graves in a cemetery in Falfurrias in 2013. Most of the remains she examines are young, but small children are rarely found. Baker believes this is because their bones are often broken or carried away by animals and are difficult to find.
I can see some signs of malnutrition. So this porous area of the bone. And so if you look here, you can see that she still retains her lacrimal bones. So she didn't have extensive vulture scavenging. I don't see any cracking of the ribs.
For Baker, this project is supposed to help those families waiting to hear from their loved ones, to let them know one way or another what happened. But that's not always possible. We leave Baker's lab for her office. It's a small room with a desk, 3 chairs, a wall of books, and another with a poster advocating for immigrant rights. I ask her what it's like to do this work.
They don't have the resources, the educational background, or any training to be able to do that. And so when I think about these families suffering, I think about how my family would deal with this situation and how unprepared and unequipped they are. And it just devastates me that there'll be so many families that never receive any sort of information.
Baker established the Reuniting Families Project in 2003. Along with her husband, Eric Baker, she assisted in the establishment of Mexico's Missing Nationals Abroad database. Now, she's working more with Central American countries.
So when I started doing the project, I really wasn't sure I wanted to continue to do it. I thought our first identification was a woman that was my age at the time. She had two young daughters, and I think I probably cried as much as her daughters did when they heard the news, because it just devastated me to think they would never see their mom again. And her whole purpose of coming to the U.S. was to be able to support them. She couldn't support them staying in Mexico. And it just seemed like I was giving bad information to a family that might rather have the hope that she would come back. And her mother was I will never forget her. She said, now I have a place to go and pray. And she was so thankful.
Baker has been doing this work for over a decade and has noticed shifts in the reasons behind migration.
When I started doing this work, people came here for economic reasons. And we could have easily fixed that in our immigration system with the guest worker program. Now people come here because they're refugees. We have people fleeing violence and conflict, and they are being threatened. They have family members and friends that are being killed. They have no other chance.
You're listening to the Making Contact documentary, Deadly Divide. To learn more about Dr. Lori Baker's work, visit radioproject.org. That's also where you can find work produced along the U.S.-Mexico border in collaboration with photojournalist Brandon Thibodeau. We'll be right back.
When Elias first left Honduras, he took a bus to the Guatemala-Mexico border. From there, he walked for 18 hours to Tenosique, Mexico, where he joined dozens of migrants on a similar journey. Vowing to look out for each other, they hopped on a northbound freight train known as La Bestia, or the Beast, at 2 a.m., often singing and chanting to keep their spirits up. Their destination is the border town of Reynosa, Tamaulipas, 60 miles south of Brooks County, Texas. It was when they reached the town of Tierra Blanca that the dangers began. Elias nearly turned back, twice.
I stayed calm. They started asking for money and wanted to know if we had family in the United States. One of the guys was fed up and said, "How much do I have to pay you all, you sons of a bitch?" "Okay, you asked for it," they told him. Right on the tracks, in front of the station. One shot in the head for each of the guys. They just dumped them in the tunnels.
His story isn't unique. Kidnappings, extortion, and murder are common for migrants traveling through Mexico.
It hurts when a comrade is killed, especially when he's good and doesn't bother anyone. Sometimes the American dream turns into a tragedy.
By the time he reached the U.S.-Mexico border, Elias had already traveled over 1,500 miles. Many migrants don't make it this far. Like thousands of others in Reynosa, he waits for a chance to cross, with all the dangers of the desert ahead. For migrants trying to cross through the South Texas desert, there are many dangers. Walking through the sand is exhausting and possibly treacherous too. Rattlesnakes and scorpions hide beneath the surface. But the biggest killers out here are heat and thirst.
Right up here is when I ran into a couple of people from El Salvador one time. And I got given in a circle to check on the stations, and they had been lost for 3 days. Going around and going around, going around, and I said, "Well, have you jumped the fence?" And he said, "No." I said, "Well, you're in the same ranch. You know, you've been going around in circles." And I gave him all the water and the food that I had, and then it dawned on me that you know, because they've been gone for 2 or 3 days already. And I said, well, maybe they wanted to be rescued. So I came back, talked to them. They wanted to be rescued. They wanted to turn themselves in because they were desperate already.
Eduardo Canales drives his truck out to this desert several times a week. He places several gallons filled with water into a large blue bin. He maintains more than 24 water stations in the desert, like this one. It looks simple enough, just a blue barrel about 3 feet high, marked in white with the Spanish word for water, agua. It doesn't seem like much, but Canales says it can save a life.
Eddie, what are we doing?
What we're doing is we're resupplying this water station right here. This one is used on a regular basis, and you can tell that the flagpole is bending on me, so I may want to at some point bring it down, but it's been very, this one's been used a lot, so over the last, we got six in here. Somebody left one behind, see? They were carrying this one, and they replaced it and left this one. I appreciate the fact that they throw it in here because I like to leave the area cleaner than when I started off with. See, they use this one, they fill that one with their one, because they have it tied up. So usually I keep a dozen to 18, so. Over the last, he picked up water here. I gave him water about 4 or 5 days ago, so it's the water's being used, you know. Let me put some more in here.
Canales is the director of the South Texas Human Rights Center and a self-described seasoned organizer. He came out of retirement to meet what he says is a dire need for migrants in Brooks County, water.
How often are you replacing these?
Well, the flag seems to be... you know, whatever it takes to replace a flag, so. The water we, once a week. All right, let's go back up. We'll go check that other one over here.
Yep.
Or back up and then go put that other one up. You know what these ladders are for, right? For people to climb over and they don't break the fence. They don't have to cut the fence or anything. They're all up and down. That's what the, you know, the ranchers are do that so that people don't destroy their fence.
Not all the local ranchers support what he's doing. He says some have fought or declined his water stations, but others see the value in his effort. Migrants that cross through South Texas often wait at the border in Reynosa, Tamaulipas. But the Mexican state has been plagued by drug violence for over a decade. Cartel gun battles and vehicle blockades happen nearly every day. Kidnapping and extortion are big business. It's here that the U.S. deports people when they are released from detention, often without money or a way to get home. I walk over the bridge from Hidalgo, Texas, to Reynosa. I cross the bridge with 20 deportees. One young man calls someone to let them know he's been deported. He says he's filthy and without a penny. With all the news of the bombings and shootings in Reynosa, I'm more than a little guarded when I cross the border to visit. I wonder if those that walk beside me are as nervous as I am. Overlooking the Rio Grande in Hidalgo, Texas, is one of a few migrant houses in Reynosa. This is where I find Elias. He is one of 9,000 migrants that have found refuge here this year. Unsure of who he could trust, he scans the courtyard for others that could hear our conversation. He wears a red soccer jersey, shorts, and a pair of sandals. He tells me that he's waiting until he can pay $100 to cross the Rio Grande, the first obstacle he'll face before walking through the desert. Lookouts are posted along its banks to ensure that no one crosses without paying the gangs.
The most difficult road remains. It was difficult to the south because of the deaths and kidnappings and everything else. the worst remains. They've told me, it's tough getting out of here. But when it's God's will, everything is possible.
Elias's father attempted to make the same crossing, but never made it out of Tamaulipas. Elias was 18 when he left.
My dad, a long story that I really don't like to tell, but he was an alcoholic, drug addict, wasting on the street. He came undocumented to the United States. He stayed here in Mexico for some time before deciding to cross to the United States.
Elias's father was one of 72 migrants that were massacred by Los Zetas drug cartel in 2010. He can't help but contemplate the fact that he's in the same place where his father died. The weight weighs heavily on him.
I'm a little afflicted because I can't leave, but everything is in time. I've got to see how things are on the outside. They're bad. I can't leave just yet. I want to stay here a little while so that I know which way the current is running, like we did in Honduras. I want to familiarize myself with the way things work here, the crossing.
When I asked him of his plan, he wasn't sure what he would do. He didn't know about the dangers in the desert, the distances between towns, or the checkpoint in Falfurrias. He didn't own a pair of boots, a map, or a compass. But what he left behind him, the violence he was fleeing, and the faith he carries, keep him motivated. As Elias tells me this, I'm reminded of Joel, the young man whose remains we found in Brooks County. Elias is only a year older and plans to walk through the same desert, but unguided. Later I tell him about Joel, his wife, and all that I learned in Brooks County. But when we spoke, he seemed set on crossing. Returning to Honduras wasn't an option.
Sí, voy a seguir. Ya estoy a un pasito de Estados Unidos y regresarme para Honduras, no.
Yes, I'm going to continue. I'm a few steps from the U.S. Turning back to Honduras? No way, I can't. I want to help my grandmother and keep my promise with God. I have a promise and I'm going to keep it. If I don't keep it, it was God's will. If I do, it was also God's will. I go with faith and God's grace. I know I'll get there.
Pero yo llego por la fe y la gracia de Dios que yo la cuajo porque la cuajo. Yo sé que voy a estar allá.
It's now midday and over 100 degrees. Some of the children play outdoors. Elias and the rest of the adults head inside to get away from the heat. His wait to cross the border continues.
And that's it for this special edition of Making Contact. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get our podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. That's also where you can see photos from Brooks County. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Quan Booth, Andrew Stelzer, Laura Flynn, Brandon Thibodeau, Mitra Kaboli, and Jasmine Lopez. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.